As the wheels of the Vetturino rolled along Naples' Strada de Toledo, Casanova found his knees pressed against those of an attractive young Roman woman returning to her native city with her husband and sister. Anna Maria D'Antoni Valatti was in her late 20s, making her nearly a decade older than Casanova. She'd been married for the best part of a decade and was childless. Anna Maria responded enthusiastically to flirtation on the road behind coach curtains and in the bedrooms of roadside inns. On a trip to Frascati, they finally consummated their affair. Standing face to face, we unlaced. We unbuttoned. Our hearts throbbed, our hands hurried to calm their impatience. Casanova insisted it was love. Alas, for anyone who thinks the pleasure of Venus is worth anything unless it comes from two hearts which love each other and are in perfect concord. In Rome, in the winter of 1743, Abarte Casanova was presented to the Pope and found that Benedict XIV liked a joke. But it was the Marchesa Gabrielli who first alerted Casanova to the fact that his affair with Anna Maria had not gone unnoticed. She even alluded to the gossip that they had been seen in the Frascati Gardens and that Anna Maria was pregnant. "Rome is small," he was warned by a fellow cleric, "and the longer you remain in Rome, the smaller you will find it." The potential scandal was avoided when Anna Maria, who was carrying Casanova's first child, returned to Naples with her husband, and Casanova was advised to leave Rome. In 1745, Casanova was due to sail for Constantinople, but was waylaid, as ever, by a love affair, one of an unusual hue. He believed himself in love with a castrated man. Castrati had a long and musically noble heritage in papal and liturgical music, and the supposedly angelic quality of their voice meant these tragedy-tainted divas earned far more than their holy male counterparts and composers. Bellino was a further rarefication of the genre, a castrato in masquerade, that is, a woman disguised as a castrated man for the purposes of her musical career. Bellino refused initially to be touched or examined by Casanova, raising an eyebrow at his insistence that he could not believe he was in love with another man. Eventually, Bellino became assured of Casanova's love and revealed the truth, that she was what Casanova only hoped she might be, a woman. The penis was fake, necessary to avoid detection by the moral arbiters of the opera and church. Once she had come clean, Casanova found it amusing to watch her apply her apparatus. "With this extraordinary attachment, she seemed to me even more interesting." Bellino's example in masquerade inspired Casanova's next mask. Sometime in May 1745, Casanova, now dressed splendidly as a Venetian junior officer, boarded the Europa, one of Venice's largest warships, for his first great overseas adventure. "I abandoned the church in favor of the army on the principle that a uniform was far more flattering than a dog collar." To Casanova, Constantinople was in some regards familiar, a fading imperial capital built on water, a maritime power semi-cloistered and segregated, but dressed in all the fabrics of the Orient. At a literary soiree, Casanova met two Turks who would shape his experience of Constantinople. One was the relatively elderly Yusuf Ali, the other Casanova refers to only as Ismail. Yusuf Ali was a philosopher and a very wealthy man. He invited Casanova first to a dinner. Casanova, as usual, assiduously recorded the honeyed drinks and meat stews of old Istanbul. Yusuf began to sound out Casanova as a prospective son-in-law. Zelmi, his daughter, was his only child whose future was insecure. His sons were independently wealthy. Then Ismail invited Casanova to a late-night fishing expedition on the Bosphorus. Casanova accepted, but things took an unexpected turn. They put ashore at Ismail's summer house and grilled the fish they had caught. Ismail then whispered that certain female members of his household were likely to bathe in the pool and that he and Casanova could watch from an adjoining garden house. Casanova agreed enthusiastically. Leading me by the hand, he opens the door. We see the whole length of the pool, lighted by the moon, and almost under our eyes, we see completely naked girls, now swimming, now coming out of the water to ascend marble steps where they exhibited themselves in every conceivable posture. It was a scene from the Arabian Nights. Three women of the Seraglio, naked in the moonlight. Casanova writes that he chose to believe everything that followed was unplanned on Ismail's part. He allowed Ismail to touch him. "Never in my life," he wrote, "have I been so beside myself. It would have been impolite to refuse." Casanova later turned down Yusuf Ali's attempted offer of high office in the Ottoman Empire and the hand of his daughter Zelmi. He returned to Venice. On returning home, Casanova was acutely aware that, aged only 20, he was viewed as a dilettante and a disappointment. Former acquaintances around Sam Samuele openly laughed at him when he secured work as a lowly fiddler. However, one March evening in 1746, after Casanova had been playing at the Palazzo Soranzo, a red-robed senator dropped a note on the ground as they queued for gondolas. Casanova returned it to the older man, who introduced himself as Senator Bragadin, and offered him a lift home. In the gondola, the senator suffered what appeared to be a stroke. Casanova acted quickly, waking a surgeon who immediately attended the senator. Later, another doctor sought to cure what he seems to have misdiagnosed as a heart attack by applying a poultice to the senator's chest. The senator rapidly deteriorated. Casanova took one of those leaps in the dark that punctuate his career. He challenged the prescription and removed the poultice. It was a breathtakingly audacious act in the context of the Venetian class structure. But the senator recovered and hailed Casanova as a genius and a healer, and asked him to move into his palazzo. "I took the most creditable, the noblest, and the only natural course," wrote Casanova, not without a hint of irony. "I decided to put myself in a position where I need no longer go without the necessities of life." With Bragadin settling on him a fairly generous allowance, a gondola, and a servant, Casanova joined that class of Venetian high society that Stendhal would later declare had lived better, more elegantly than perhaps any other in history. And so begins Casanova's period as a gentleman of leisure in Venice, until, at the happy age of 23, he met the woman with the clearest claim to have been the love of his life. There was a commotion in the corridor of the Cesena boarding house where Casanova was staying. A Hungarian officer was arguing with the Italian landlord. Another man was in bed in the officer's room, but the landlord was threatening the Hungarian with the Inquisition because he suspected the interloper to be a woman. Casanova chose to side with the foreigner against the locals and act as translator. He was also, of course, intrigued by the person in the Hungarian's bed. The Hungarian disclosed his bedmate, a tousled, crop-haired Frenchwoman, dressed as a soldier, who called herself Henriette. They were travelling companions and bedfellows in an arrangement that was as unconventional as it was dangerous. To sleep with a woman who dressed as a man was to invite more than curiosity from the Inquisition, for, unlike Bellino, Henriette made no real attempt to hide her femininity. They were heading for Parma, and Casanova immediately reconsidered his travel plans. In his memoirs, The History of My Life, Casanova is soon calling Henriette the masquerader and an adventuress. He was now smitten by a kind of wit I greatly admired, and decided to win her from the Hungarian. He suggested to Henriette that she carry on to Parma with him as her replacement protector. Then, at an inn at Reggio, between Bologna and Piacenza, Casanova and Henriette became lovers. They who believe that a woman is incapable of making a man equally happy all the 24 hours of the day have never known an Henriette. Henriette had run away from an abusive husband, and seemingly father-in-law. She was waiting for some sort of rapprochement with her in-laws or husband, perhaps the granting of an official separation or the right to see her children without bringing further scandal on the family. Now she had happened upon a wild young adventurer who shared her outlook on life and love. With Henriette, Casanova dropped his guard. He admitted his precarious finances and future. Henriette worried about what Casanova spent on her, and dropped hints that the flower of their happiness came seeded with the likelihood of its ending. "Those who say that one can be happy all one's life talk to no purpose," she told him. "Pleasure, to be such, has to end." It was a Monsieur Antoine Blacas of Provence who recognized her. At an evening garden party at Colonno, the ducal summer residence outside Parma. Henriette's family must have acquiesced to her terms, because Henriette told Casanova that they must part. "Let us never forget each other. I do not know who you are, but I know that no one in the world knows you better than I do. I wish you to love again, and even to find another Henriette." Casanova was distraught. She sent him a letter from the first staging post at Châtillon, simply adieu, and scratched a message in the glass of the bedroom window with the diamond ring he had bought her. "You will also forget Henriette." She had read Casanova well, but on that last point she was wrong. He never forgot her. In his History of My Life, Casanova records sexual experiences with well more than 100 women and a handful of men. Casanova was certainly very sexually active in his 20s and early 30s, but for an almost constantly travelling bachelor of his era, his sex life begins to appear more modest. Lord Byron, for instance, alludes to more conquests in a couple of years in the Palazzo Mocenigo in Venice than Casanova did in an entire lifetime. In the classic 18th-century sense, Casanova is a poor example of a libertine, in that he had little interest in conquest or coercion. He was no Valmont or de Sade. He's outclassed 10-1 by his fictional alter ego, Don Giovanni, with his catalogue of 1,800 conquests. Rather, he enjoyed the game of love and seduction, a sport or art of unsurpassed fashionability in the generation that preceded the French Revolution. He narrates affairs rather than one-night stands. Romantically, he was indefatigable. Years later, he wrote of his affair with Henriette. "When I consider what makes me happy in my old age, it is the presence of my memory, and I conclude that my life must have been more happy than unhappy. And I congratulate myself. No, I have not forgotten her. And it is balm to my soul every time I remember."